you. Thank you. Be seated. Welcome to the 3 o'clock docket at the Second Court of Appeals. We did have another case. Has anybody heard about Ken? What happened? I'm sorry?
I believe he came off the docket yesterday.
Yeah, well, he was in the hospital.
No, I hadn't heard.
At least that's what I heard, and then so I was just concerned. Didn't know if it was a car wreck or what it was. Anyway, your panel this afternoon is to my right, Justice Sue Walker. To my left, Justice Bob McCoy. I'm Leanne Dofino. So because of something, I don't know what, you are our only case for this afternoon, so you may get more questions than you're expecting. All right, both sides ready? All right, would you call the case, please? Hey, David, you ready?
Yes. May it please the court, I'm David Pearson, office here in Fort Worth, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant, William Roberts. The facts of this case are relatively dry, and not surprisingly, but they're not in dispute. Let me back up to say Mr. Roberts was convicted in a bench trial that was also a combination hearing on his motion to suppress. He received 17 years on both cases for possession of over 4 to 200 grams of methamphetamine with intent to deliver. He was also convicted of possession of over 400 grams with intent to deliver gamma hydroxybutyrate. Sorry about that. Again, the facts are dry, but they're not really in dispute, at least not on any point that would, I think, drive the decision in this case. It was in the morning. The officer noticed Mr. Roberts in his vehicle, in a car, make a U-turn, pull into a parking spot, and the officer noticed that he had paper dealer tags that were out of date, pulled in behind him after he pulled into a private business parking lot. He was parked there legally. The officer, after he pulled over, after Mr. Roberts pulled over, the officer activated his lights, began his traffic stop. He was not parked in such a way that was obstructing traffic or a valid public safety concern. And jumping ahead a little bit, we know that, I think, in part because that's where the officer conducted the inventory search, which is what, of course, this case is about. And now he did begin at that point. He asked him, did he have a license? Did he have the proper proof of insurance? And Mr. Robert, the appellant, said no, he did not. And it was shortly after that, after he issued the citations, that the inventory search began. Now, what makes this case unusual, I believe, even amongst the cases cited by the state throughout their brief, a lot of them, this is not an inventory where the driver or the occupant of the vehicle was under arrest. We do have a pretty rare circumstance where the inventory search precedes the arrest, and there's no argument about that. And I think it's important to not lose sight of that, to view this case through that prism. Now, I'm not saying that's some sort of a bright line rule, but it is unusual, and it's easy to forget it. The tow policy that the officer relied upon under the Arlington Police Department it's stated in the record in State's Exhibit Number 28, where they stop a driver on a traffic violation that's failed to maintain financial responsibility, has a previous conviction of that, does not possess a valid driver's license, or has any outstanding warrants. Ipso facto, because of that, because those factors are found, or one or more of them are found, the inventory search is presumptively valid. However, I think under the Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution, it sort of begs the question, even under the Supreme Court jurisprudence of South Dakota versus Operman, you have to have a lawfully impounded automobile. And what we're contending on behalf of the appellant is that under these circumstances, without an arrest, and under these circumstances, and also sort of a sub part, because the policy was not adhered to technically or precisely, that this search was unreasonable. And that's our basic contention. I'm not taking on Fourth Amendment law to state that inventory searches are not a valid exception to a warrantless search.
Okay, David, I got a question. All the stuff was in the trunk, is that right?
The stuff that was incriminating,
but
yes.
What about the Bunsen burner, cigarette lighters, and the glass pipe? That wasn't in the trunk.
Right, I'm sorry, you're correct.
Okay.
Yes, it was in the, I think in the floorboard or somewhere in the passenger area.
Okay, but the drugs were in the trunk?
Yes.
And the trunk locks? So is that like a locked box? The officer couldn't search it without having the key. If you're trying to protect it from the tow truck driver, why not just leave the key with the owner of the vehicle? I mean, if they have to tow it. I know you've got another argument that they didn't even have to tow it. Also, another question is, the law has changed, and you can no longer sue a municipality or a police department for things that are stolen out of your car. Isn't that right? That they're no longer liable for things that are stolen out of your car? So does that affect their ability to do an inventory search? Because the inventory search is to protect them against lawsuit, not to protect you against having stuff stolen out of your car. So can you answer all my questions?
Well, I'm not certain about the change in the law that you referred to, but as far as the keys, there, if I'm understanding the case law correctly, there's a precedent for if they can open areas of the vehicle that are shut, but you can access them with a key. You have to have a warrant, I think, to get into, to break open a container or get it pried open somehow. That would have to be pursuant to a warrant. But
the officer had to take the key away from somebody.
And that the record is not clear on that. There was nobody could say for certain whether another officer handed in the key, or it was never, there's nothing in the record that it was taken from Mr. Roberts. It just somehow wound up in the hands of an officer, a different officer.
We can presume that whoever was driving the car had a key.
Correct. And ultimately, even though I'm saying that I'm admitting the record's not clear, I think it's pretty obvious, it's implicit in the record that it came from Mr. Roberts, that they took possession of his keys. And which, of course, we know from Florida versus Wells, one of the cases I wanted to cite was that an inventory search must not be a ruse for general rummaging in order to discover incriminating evidence. Before I go into the factors, I do want to get to this contention that the case, another thing that marks this case as unusual is there was this pseudo detention of Mr. Roberts. The officer was clear in his testimony that he just wanted him to be there to sort of observe, to be standing by while they were inventorying the contents of the vehicle.
That makes perfect sense. I want to be sure that you see that whatever's here that belongs to you that I write down here on this chart, because it's your stuff, and I want to be sure that I'm inventorying it correctly.
Well, I do think from that standpoint it makes sense. I'll only mention it, Justice McCoy, to highlight the fact that I think this case sort of epitomizes the slippery slope. The officer knew that he was not. He had issued him citations. He didn't arrest him. He did not have an offense committed in his presence that he decided to make an arrest for. Yet he said that the appellant could walk away, but yet he said, and out of the other side of his mouth, he needed him to stay. I'm not suggesting that bad faith is a factor here, but it is peculiar that the police are saying we needed to do an inventory under our policy, our tow policy for driving on the streets without a failure to maintain financial responsibility. We need to do this inventory to protect the three, you know, to protect you, to protect us, to protect ourselves from danger. But yet they want this, the individual, to stay on, to stand by, to watch. And he was not detained, but yet he was also really and truly not free to leave, even though jurisprudence may say that he was.
All right. You just mentioned financial responsibility, and in your brief, you hammer a little bit on asking for insurance and asking for financial responsibility. What would that mean outside of insurance?
Well, the Texas, if this is what you're alluding to, the Texas Transportation Code under 601.051 and 601.053 mention under the ways in which a motorist can show proof of financial responsibility, including a surety bond on deposit with the comptroller.
How would one do that to the officer after a stop? I mean,
well,
has a surety bond with him?
I was just citing the fact that the Sanchez case reversed on insufficiency of the evidence, where the driver in that case was only asked one question, and the record was clear: do you have insurance? And he did not have an insurance card, but the court reversed for insufficient evidence because he was never asked, he was never given the opportunity to show that he could have met the other formats or the other ways in which you can show proof of financial responsibility.
SR-22, is that what it is?
I don't know that it's an SR-22. I guess it has a lot of similarities to that, but the transportation code under those sections provides for, you can even provide a certificate of self-insurance or some type of certificate of deposit with the appropriate county judge. As far as the factors that are in case
Mr.
law.
Mr. Pearson, yes. I have a question. Are you drawing a distinction, or do you think there is a distinction between the impoundment and the inventory? And are there different criteria attached to those two police actions, or are those one and the same?
I don't believe, for my purposes and the limb that I'm, or the sort of the hill I'm trying to stake, where I'm trying to plant a flag, I do think they're distinguishable, they're different. I don't see that from my viewpoint, we're contending the vehicle was seized unlawfully. It was seized outside of the law, so therefore the inventory is not really where I'm sort of parking my emphasis. It's really on the seizure, the impoundment. And that's the whole, which is the factors that I was just mentioning. I believe they all weigh in the appellant's favor, the factors from case law in terms of the reasonableness of the impoundment, whether someone was available at the arrest scene to whom the police officer could have given possession of the vehicle. Well, he wasn't under arrest. So he'd been issued a citation. It's a separate, on that factor, you could have given him possession of the vehicle. I grant you, he couldn't have driven it at that point. Whether the vehicle was impeding the flow of traffic or was a danger to public safety, no, it was not.
But let's back up for a minute as a practical matter. He couldn't drive it. His girlfriend shows up in her car. Well, she can't leave, or in a car alone. She can't leave with both cars.
True.
So, and then, I'm not sure. Are you sure that financial responsibility encompasses someone else's car? Remember, this is a loaner. This isn't, I've got an SR-22 or I've got some kind of bond to drive my car. It's not my car. And they couldn't call the body shop because the body shop wasn't open. So, as a practical matter, it's screaming impoundment to me. And I understand you got to get to impoundment, a correct impoundment, before you get to inventory.
Yes.
So if you can hit at impoundment, then you don't get to inventory. I got that. But what about those practical situations facing the police officer out there?
Well, and not to take issue with your question, I'm certainly not trying to dodge it. I'm just saying that under the other factors, he wasn't being detained. He himself, the individual, with a set of keys where he could lock and secure. The idea behind inventory is to secure the contents, to protect the individual, to protect the police. So if he is there, standing there with the key, able to secure the contents, and And he himself is an individual. If he cares about the contents, about this loaner car, he can call that business as soon as it opens and say, bring a legal driver over here, bring a tow truck over here, do something, but your car is here, my stuff is in it, come and get it. I maybe I'm giving myself too much credit to say this is a close case, but I do think it's a close case on terms of individual rights, because their policy wasn't followed in terms of they just asked for an insurance card. That's one strike against, at least in that scenario, it's one strike against the government. There was, another factor of reasonableness of the impoundment is whether there was some reasonable connection between the arrest and the vehicle. Again, there was never an arrest. That weighs in favor of the appellant. Whether the vehicle was used in the commission of the crime, this inventory preceded all of the, it preceded any discovery of a crime. That weighs in favor of the appellant. The Benavidez case, which I've cited, and in the state's also cited, a very foretelling quote in there: constitutional protections cannot be abrogated by police procedures. And again, the Fourth Amendment protection against seizures cannot be whittled away by police regulation. In summary, and I'll reserve the rest of my time for questions.
Because I've got another question. It seems to me I read that the police officer did not complete the inventory form.
That's correct.
There is an old case that says when a police officer doesn't complete the inventory form, that is a suggestion of a sham inventory. It's an old, old case. Don't know if it's been treated lately, but how can it be an inventory if you don't complete the inventory? I mean, how does it do what this rule is supposed to accomplish?
I think under the circumstances of my case, and this does not weigh in our favor in this case, is that everything that was of any value, according to their testimony on the record, was that it was all contraband. It was something in connection with the evidence of the crime that led them to seize that as evidence. So that when you subtract all that, according to the testimony, which in the court filed findings of fact, I don't know that he touched on this exactly, but the record before the trial court was that, well, everything that was of any value was seized in connection with the investigation of a crime. There was a pair of sneakers that was not worth $20. That was the other.
I think he testified that he filled out the card for the inventory, and then when he got to the inventory list, everything that was left after the seizure was valued individually at less than $20. So he had nothing to inventory according to the Arlington Police Department policy. Wasn't that what the testimony
right.
was?
Right, yes, and except for, I was saying that the very last thing I was saying is that there was something about a pair of sneakers that he didn't think was worth $20, and there may have been a few other little incidental items that together didn't amount to $20 of value. All right, thank you.
May it please the court. The trial court made very detailed findings of fact and conclusions of law. As the state has articulated in pretty great detail in its brief, those findings of fact were supported by the record. This court must therefore give almost total deference to those findings of fact. Moreover, where the court has not made findings of fact since it overruled the motion to suppress, this court must impute sufficient findings to uphold the trial court's ruling if it's correct on any theory of the law. The trial court's conclusions of law adopted, basically, as the state points out, there seem to be two different approaches to inventory searches. One is the basic, is there a policy for, I'm sorry, inventory searches, let me back up, for tows or impoundments. The first one, as the state outlined, is one, is there a policy for a uniform policy that the police department has adopted for towing, and two, did the police follow that? That seems to be the law that the trial court was following in its findings of fact. It cited cases to that effect, in its conclusions of law, and its findings of fact, it only made specific findings of fact as to whether a policy existed and whether it was followed. The second way of analyzing whether a tow has been in compliance with the Fourth Amendment is just to look at it overall as whether the tow was reasonable under the circumstances. The trial court made no specific findings to support that sort of analysis, and it didn't make any conclusions of law under that particular line of analysis. Nevertheless, if this court were to conclude that that is the law that should be applied in this particular case, and the Texas state courts are split on that, then this court would have to impute the findings to support that. And I believe, as the state has articulated in its brief, there is sufficient evidence in the record to support those findings that it was reasonable under all the circumstances. Addressing Justice Dofano's argument that, or question regarding whether the trunk, the fact that the trunk was closed and locked, somehow vitiates the legitimacy of the search of the trunk, the officer testified that there was a written policy that specifically stated if there was a container that could be accessed through a key and the officer or someone there had the key, then the officers were required to use the key, access whatever container it happened to be, and inspect it for valuables and the like as part of the inventory.
Let me ask you a hypothetical question then. Hypothetically, driver's out of the car, drops the keys in his pocket, not under arrest, not a threat to the officer, no indication of a threat to the officer. Can the officer search the driver in order to get the key to open the trunk?
Hypothetically, I would have to say the officer can't search for that sole purpose, no. I believe the officer could ask him to surrender the keys and he could voluntarily give them. In this case, however, the defendant himself testified that he left the keys in the ignition, and that one of the officers reached in, actually it was the second officer who responded, the woman, reached in, took the keys, gave them to the record driver. When the first officer began his inventory search, he retrieved the keys from the record driver and opened the trunk. So that, yours is a hypothetical situation since the record in this case doesn't support that scenario.
So the search doesn't go to the person. The ability to search doesn't go to the person unless there's a threat to the officer or a traditional reason to search. The mere fact that he's been pulled over and doesn't have proof of financial responsibility doesn't give them the authority to search him, just his car.
No, it wouldn't extend to see to the fact that whether he has any contraband on him, because the justification for an inventory search, as the Supreme Court and the Court of Criminal Appeals have repeatedly emphasized, is to protect both the owner of the car or the vehicle and the police themselves for any claims of damage, vandalism, loss, theft, what have you. That justification wouldn't apply to a search of the individual.
Okay, I think the law is pretty clear about once it's impounded, it can be inventoried. I think you need to address that it could be impounded under these circumstances.
If you use the first line of analysis, did they have a policy, was it a written policy, and did they follow it, then the impoundment was lawful under the Fourth Amendment. The Arlington Police Department did have a tow policy, a separate tow policy, separate and apart, and even in a completely different subsection of their manual for towing, and under what circumstances something can be either discretionarily towed or mandatorily towed. And the officer testified in detail about that. They introduced the actual portions of the manual that apply to that, and the officer said that he testified to it. The trial court made a specific finding of fact, finding 15 of his findings of fact. I beg your pardon. That's the inventories. The court made a specific finding, I couldn't tell you which number it was, that they had a policy in place and the officers followed it. If you follow line of analysis, then it was consonant with the Fourth Amendment.
Are you talking about the second approach as you've got it in here, that's the one factor or the two factors?
I beg your pardon? Your two
approaches are on page 13, and I'm asking you, are you talking about the one that's got The very first one under the two-prong
analysis. And there's a second prong. It's simply whether it's reasonable or not under the under the totality of the circumstances. This trial court made no specific findings of fact as to the reasonableness or a lot of the factors that might go into a reasonableness analysis. Nevertheless, the record, if this court must impute findings that would support the trial court's ruling, which was to overrule the motion to suppress, so this court must impute from the record, under the totality of the circumstances, facts that would facts would support the conclusion that.
Okay, let's suppose that we
it was reasonable.
Look at the U.S. versus Smith approach.
U.S. versus
Smith.
Smith.
The one which got the two parts.
Yes, sir.
The first part is. Is the standard reasonable? So let's say we look at the standard and it's reasonable. And the second part is they followed the procedure.
Correct.
How do you address the question about the procedure called for financial responsibility and he only inquired about insurance and the Sanchez case, which apparently found that to be inadequate?
I would distinguish the Sanchez case on the basis of the Sanchez case held that the evidence was insufficient to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant in that case didn't have financial any financial responsibility on the car. That's not the issue here. The issue here was whether the officer had probable cause to believe that the defendant in this case didn't have financial responsibility. Under the totality of the circumstances, Sanchez is a case in which the defendant was prosecuted for failing to have financial financial responsibility on his vehicle.
Right.
The court in Sanchez said all the state introduced evidence about was whether the state asked him whether he had insurance. The defendant, who was a limited English speaker, responded, "No, I don't have insurance." And then the investigating officer never followed up. And they never proved up at trial that not only did he not have any insurance, he didn't have any other proof of financial responsibility, would have been difficult to prove a negative like that. Nevertheless, the court said you didn't prove it beyond a reasonable doubt.
How about here? The officer asked him, apparently.
In this case, officer doesn't have insurance. He admits that he doesn't have insurance.
Right.
Further admits that he doesn't own the car.
Right.
Further admits that he doesn't know anything more about the car or its insurance or its financial responsibility. And the officer further testified that when they ran searches on any sort of insurance for the defendant or in the defendant's name, they couldn't find anything. It would be a reasonable conclusion and lead to probable cause to believe that he didn't have financial responsibility to on the vehicle, given those facts, and further given that, it would be a reasonable conclusion based on those facts that he didn't have financial responsibility, which would leave the officer to have probable cause to write him for the citation, which he did, and to require that the car be impounded. That really, practically, as Your Honor even pointed out, practically there's very little more that he could have done. The car repair place was closed. It wouldn't be open for another hour. There were no other way to search for any sort of financial responsibility. Given that hour of the morning, I question whether even any state agency that they could have checked with might have. But there's nothing in the Fourth Amendment that says that that a investigating officer has to go to those links in order to determine whether he has financial responsibility or not.
The financial responsibility.
Can I address your?
I think I got just a little bit lost on.
It's the difference between proving it beyond a reasonable doubt and just having probable cause to believe that he didn't have financial responsibility.
It kind of gone off on, was it the officer's reasonable belief that he didn't have financial responsibility, and that's where you kind of threw me off there. I mean, to me,
There's nothing in the Fourth Amendment that says the officer has to prove to his has to have established beyond a reasonable doubt that he doesn't have financial responsibility before he can conclude, before he can tow the vehicle. The Fourth Amendment only requires reasonableness of the state. it was reasonable for him to conclude under all the facts as he could ascertain them at the time that he did not have the requisite financial responsibility.
Here's what I'm reading, and I guess I'm hung up on reasonable. Under this two-step approach, it says, a community caretaking impoundment must be based on, one, a reasonable standard police procedure governing decisions. Okay, we look at the policy, is it reasonable? Then the second one doesn't have the word reasonable in it. It just says the police must have followed the procedure in the case involved. And I think his point is the police, it didn't say anything about reasonable belief or anything. It just says, did they follow the policy? And I think his point is that they didn't because they didn't inquire about financial responsibility. And I'm not saying that's a deal breaker. I'm just inquiring about how do you address that?
I address that by saying that the Fourth Amendment is at its heart an analysis of reasonableness.
Right, an unreasonable
so that
search.
A reasonable, and when we look at the facts as the officer knew them at the time, in just about any other Fourth Amendment context, we look at what the officer reasonably had before him and what the officer reasonably understood. I am unaware of any other Fourth Amendment case in any context that would require the officers to know beyond a reasonable doubt some fact before they can act on and seize or search an item or an area.
Well, they couldn't know that because the person could lie. I don't have insurance. Well, in fact, he does. That doesn't mean beyond a reasonable doubt he doesn't, because he could be lying. So.
Correct, which I think reinforces the state's position that ultimately the analysis has to examine whether, under the totality of the circumstances, the officer's actions were reasonable.
Okay, Chip, so I have a car, and my car is insured. My car is insured no matter who's driving it, right?
Okay. It's your hypothetical.
All right. And it's not going to be in the name of the person who's driving it, the insurance. Insurance is going to be in my name. So this car belongs to somebody else. I mean, that's the one thing that nobody argues about throughout the whole case. This car doesn't belong to the driver. It belongs to somebody else. So the fact that it belongs to somebody else means that that's who you look to see another source of looking to see whether there's insurance. And insurance by another person is proof of financial responsibility. If you drive a rental car, if you take your car in to get it repaired and they give you a junker to drive while your car is being repaired and they've got the insurance, you're not going to have the insurance card on that car. They've got the insurance, and that's where you look for responsibility, right?
The issue here was whether the tow and then the subsequent inventory was reasonable under the circumstances.
Yeah.
So you, in your brief, I don't know if it's correct or not, you say later you confirmed that the appellant did not have a valid driver's license and that the vehicle had no valid proof of responsibility. So it sounded like to me you went back to your database and found that this car had no insurance on it. That's what I drew from this, but I may be
the
wrong.
Officer testified that they ran a search and couldn't find any insurance on the car whatsoever.
Okay.
So factually, yours is a hypothetical that's different from this case. But to address your hypothetical, mm-hmm. The issue here is whether the officers determined that there was no insurance on the car before instituting the mandatory tow policy. So that if, say, someone else was driving your car and it had insurance, then the officers would have determined that there was insurance on the car and the mandatory policy would not have kicked in.
So your
argument may be quite valid as to the citation that the officer wrote the defendant for simply driving the car without insurance. I don't know. I'm going to have to look at the citation and the statute
that applies. If I'm driving a car that has been provided me either by rental or because my car is being repaired, and I'm driving down the road and something doesn't look right and I'm in Arlington, Arlington can pull me over. I can park legally so that I'm not violating any law. Park legally. They can search that car hang anything they find on that in that car on me, tow the car so that I'm responsible for the cost of the towing, whatever, and leave me stranded on the sidewalk in the middle of the night because that's their policy.
The defendant was stopped, and the defendant was seen operating the motor vehicle without insurance. Motor vehicles in Texas, by state law, without insurance, can't be operated on the highway. There was no one to whom the car could be turned over, no one who could be called within a reasonable amount of time. So under your scenario, if it were that extreme, yes, the officers could impound the car and tow it. The whole point is to keep the car from being driven on the highway, because without insurance, it's a threat to life and limb on the highway. Right, and there's absolutely no recourse.
Suppose he pulled into his driveway, not into a legal spot on a parking lot, but his driveway. Could they have towed
it? It's not being operated on the highway at that point.
Well, it wasn't when it was in the parking lot either.
Perhaps in your hypothetical, yes, the officer's conduct in that hypothetical would be considered unreasonable for Fourth Amendment purposes. But in this case, he was seen to be operating the car on the highway and was cited for it.
But if I'm seen operating it, my point is it was parked legally when the police officer got there. Suppose it, instead of being parked in a parking lot, it was parked in my driveway, even though you'd seen me driving it. Would you still be able to pull it?
No, because there, at that point, there are other reasonable alternatives that the officer has readily available and can investigate and can deduce, i.e., hey, wow, I checked the registration. It's the same as the house that this is parked in. We can just leave it here. That would be Benavides and some of the other cases. But in this instance, on the roadway, and by the way, there is a dispute in the testimony as to where exactly he was parked. The arresting officer said that the defendant pulled over on the side of the street in a parking spot on the side of the street in front of the business. The defendant testified that he pulled into a parking lot and parked there. I agree with opposing counsel. It's ultimately a distinction without a difference. But if he really did park on the side of the street, that brings it much more in line with a lot of the cases which say officers can tow vehicles that are left on the side of the roadway or the side of the street because they present more of a potential hazard to other cars, other drivers, pedestrians, et cetera, et cetera. Also, addressing your...
I'm
out of time.
Addressing
your question as to whether a change in the law, which I am not aware of, but a change in the law that apparently allows or does not allow individuals to sue various police agencies for items or damage to their cars, the state would maintain that an inventory search is still under the theory behind that justifies the inventory searches. Inventory searches are still permissible. The inventory is not only the inventory is to protect not only the police from being sued, but to protect a defendant by having the item that the things there itemized, so that they look at the items and say, "Ah, I really didn't leave that in my car. It wasn't lost. It hasn't been gone." Moreover, as one of the officers testified, that the narcotics officer who testified, he came out and tested the chemicals. When they do an inventory search, they also look for hazardous materials. Hazardous materials, I would suggest, that are very similar to what they found in the defendant's car. Materials that potentially could cause harm to anyone who comes in contact with a car. They could be combustible. They could have vapors or odors that could eventually harm someone something along those lines. So an inventory search would still be justified under that theory, that we're merely protecting ourselves, the tow truck drivers, wherever we store the vehicle. So that inventory would be still justified under the Fourth Amendment under such a theory, even if the police officers couldn't be sued either individually or as an office for items that may be lost or damaged.
Any other questions?
State prays for an affirmance.
David?
May I please the court briefly? The findings of fact I want to go to touch on something that my opponent mentioned. In the findings of fact number two, the court.
What page are you on?
On the record, page.
Oh, record. I don't have
in the record. I'm sorry, page 62 okay. In the clerk's record, but that the sergeant followed the vehicle which executed a U-turn at the light and pulled into a business parking lot, and he again observed the expired paper dealer tags. So at least we know from the findings of fact as adopted by the trial court reflect that he pulled into a business parking space. Now, ultimately, it may not matter a huge deal, but I do think that that small fact does have bearing on this. To me, is the respectfully is the policy, the tail wagging the dog. The policy was not, in another way, was not adhered to. From the state's exhibit number 28, when it cites the conditions in subsection C of the vehicles that can be towed, the officers will always ask for proof of financial responsibility from all vehicle drivers. They use the language there, financial responsibility. Number two under C, officers will make every effort to verify financial responsibility before authorizing impoundment of the vehicle. A citation may be issued if the person fails to maintain financial responsibility and does not meet any of the above conditions. Going to what Justice McCoy was raising, if you were going to say following the tow policy, as the Smith opinion in the state's brief, if you have a policy and you follow it, therefore it's reasonable, I think is dangerous turf. Because in this situation, the officer did not follow it exactly. Therefore, it moves us down the slippery slope. And Justice Stoffino, you stole my thunder a little bit. I did want to raise one scenario, and you're already there. But I would liken this to if I pulled into a Walmart parking lot at the very edge of the parking lot and the police officer was on his way responding to a description of a shoplifter that was short guy wearing glasses, kind of grayish, Caucasian. So he decides to stop and talk to me as I'm getting out of a Civic. And he asks me, do you have an insurance card? And I say, well, it expired yesterday. My insurance was out yesterday. At that moment, he could say, Mr. Pearson, I'm seizing your vehicle. And I really think if that's reasonable, if this case is reasonable, then that scenario is just as reasonable in Arlington.
Maybe I'm misreading the policy, but I thought the policy is that they would tow the car when they had no insurance and no valid Texas driver's license.
Right. And, not or.
Right.
So that's a little bit different. That, to me, seems to be under the reasonableness umbrella, a little more reasonable. If someone doesn't have a driver's license and they're out there driving the car and they don't have insurance, That would eliminate your scenario or change the scenario that you posed a little bit.
Well, and I'm trying to rush through it, and I apologize. I was going to say that he asked me for my identification. I say I left my wallet at home. I don't have a driver's license. My insurance expired yesterday.
And it's not your car.
Well,
what we got here. It's not his car. There is no insurance. The temporary tags expired. And he didn't have a driver's license. That's quite a bit of stuff.
A lot of those circumstances do mount against us. But what we're saying is, if you look at it from a reasonableness point of view, the car is safely parked. It's not a public safety violation. It's not in a spot where it's obstructing any traffic. It's at a business parking lot, which presumably you can be there for up to an hour without them calling the police that you're violating some sort of trespassing laws there. If it's a business parking lot, and the court was clear on that, if it's parked in a business parking lot, and again, this man was not arrested before the seizure of his car, even after he said, it's not my vehicle, it's a loaner, but he's not under arrest. I guess what I'm suggesting is, respectfully, if you take a step back and look at it, why is it necessary? Why is it reasonable to say, okay, we're seizing this car. We're just seizing it. The impoundment, in our view, is not reasonable because all the circumstances militated for letting the driver, the appellant, secure his own property, worry about the person that loaning the vehicle, worry about them coming to get it, worry about them providing the proper financial responsibility on their own vehicle. Why is it just so quickly seized? And again, the very strange, peculiar aspect of this case where he's told to stay close by, I think, speaks to possibly bad faith that this is a ruse for a search. We really want you to be right here in case we find something that we're in fact looking for. We would ask that the case be reversed and remanded to the trial court. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We appreciate your argument. You might have a word with Ken Gordon to tell him that you didn't appreciate all the extra questions. Your case is submitted. You're free to go about your business, and this court will be adjourned.